This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. For this season of Working, we left the East Coast behind and flew to Detroit. We're speaking with eight people who are drawing on the city's complex history as they work to create its future. In this week's episode, we're speaking with Diana Nucera, director of Detroit Community Technology Project. Almost 40% of Detroit's residents have no access to broadband internet in their homes, which, among other things, potentially deprives them of economic opportunities by cutting them off from job possibilities. Nucera talked about the ways that she and her organization are aiming to allay that really severe digital divide gap, telling us about how they try to cultivate tech literacy in Detroit communities and how they train organizers. But she also goes into her own day-to-day role as a nonprofit director in Detroit and tells us a little about her own background in the DIY punk movement. Then, in a Slate Plus Extra, Nucera shares her perspective on what net neutrality means for Detroit. If you're a member, enjoy bonus segments and interview transcripts from Working, plus other great podcast exclusives. Start your two-week free trial at slate.com/workingplus.
What is your name and what do you do?
My name is Diana Nucera, and I'm the director of the Detroit Community Technology Project, which is a sponsored project of Allied Media Projects.
What does that involve? What are you up to?
Right. So I think the easiest way to explain it to folks that gets them to maybe ask more questions
sure.
is I help people make their own internet.
Okay.
And then I also demystify technology in a way that allows people to teach it mm-hmm. in a more community-oriented way. So mm-hmm. being able to sort of disseminate really complex technological concepts to folks that often aren't considered when they think about technology education. So for instance, poor neighborhoods in Detroit that are highly affected by having access to digital technologies, or working with technologists to be able to teach in a way that is more inclusive and accessible to a more diverse audience. And one of the big things that we work on is this problem that we have in Detroit, which is that 40% of Detroiters are without internet at all.
And not just broadband, but also not on phones or other.
Right. Ways. So it's both broadband and mobile. Mm-hmm. So any sort of fixed connection is not, folks don't have that here. And so it's a big problem when you consider the economic issues of Detroit and the also rapid change of Detroit.
Right.
So classism exists already, right? Where you have newcomers that are coming in and seeing whoa, these houses are so cheap, I'm going to buy them all, you know, mm-hmm. To people who have lived here for a very long time and have struggled and sort of staying in the city. One thing that I'm really aware of and worried about is with this new gigabit internet that we have being built in Detroit, that we not only create this economic class, but then we're also bringing that into the digital space and creating this digital class system that is really determined on how fast your internet is and what you can do with it on top of not know what to do with mm-hmm. it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as I understand it, one of the real crises of extreme digital divides of that nature, especially in a developing economy, is that people don't have access to the economy because job applications and things like this, or even job listings, are all happening online. So,
yeah, but and it's also, I think that's a very common narrative too, that the internet equals jobs, but it's so much more. It equals connection to your community, to your loved ones, to your to community outside of even this country. And also social services. Like, you can't apply for a bridge card in an office. You have to do it online. So how are you going to access that if you don't have the internet? So then social, it's like, it is jobs, but it's social services and it is community and other resources, because the internet is interweaved in our lives in really complex ways, from your fancy watch that shows you what to do all day to day, to just like my ability to even communicate, to have this interview to take place.
Right. So what is the kind of nature of the organization? Is it a governmental institution, an NGO? What's your status?
So Allied Media Projects is a 501c3, and it's a nonprofit, because we sort of are sponsored projects within that. We are a nonprofit, but we do intersect in all these different ways of like community organizing, art, technology, and policy. So some of our work is around thinking about open data ordinances, specifically the one that just happened in Detroit. How does that affect people's lives? How do people have access to that in a way that really enhances the way they're already doing work?
What does that involve here in Detroit?
The open data project that we're doing here in Detroit involves working with this group called the Digital Justice Coalition, which formed in 2009, which was a moment in which Detroit was, the big question about Detroit was, is it worth being saved? Which is completely different than the narrative today, which is Opportunity Detroit. And at the time, our question was, is what can the role of media and technology be in building new economies based in mutual aid? And so the Digital Justice Coalition sort of formed in order to create a body that is full of multiple perspectives, from seniors to artists to technologists and different NGOs around the city, to really think about the value of technology and the internet. And I say that leading up to this data project because it's really come out of the work of the DDJC, because the ordinance that was created around open data in like February of 2015, I believe, what it did is it put people's data online, not just the cities, not just the interactions that people are having in government to make government more transparent, which I think is mainly the goal of open data, but it also puts citizen data online.
When you say citizen data, what does that mean?
Or residence data. So basically like your unpaid parking tickets, your license registration, your taxes, your water shutoffs, all of that then becomes a part of that portal.
Seems like that could potentially be privacy violation.
Well, yes, it could also potentially harm and further criminalize people that are often criminalized. So when you think about a neighborhood, for instance, that is maybe facing some crime or whatever, but is in the midst of this real estate sort of change, like that open data about that neighborhood can sort of shift the opportunities that those residents have. And that's what we dove into it as the Digital Justice Coalition, to really think about like, well, what does open data mean to like the day-to-day person, not just the journalists, not just the app developers, not just the building developers, but how can it be beneficial and also harmful to those who just live in the city? And we realize that there's not a whole lot of actual cases of people using it to their benefit. And so we started really working on understanding, like, one, what are people's relationship with data? We're in this culture where we're constantly giving away our information. You get a library card, you get a license, we have this one workshop that we do that's called What's in Your Wallet. And it's basically picking out all the cards in your wallet and like thinking about all the information you had to give away in order to get those cards. Where does that information live? And what kind of data trail does that leave for you and how does that affect your life and your neighborhood? Because I don't think people realize that their consumer data and having access to all of this actually flips a neighborhood. Because people will, like, let's say with this new legislation around the internet service providers being able to sell our user data, they can sell that to a company that's trying to figure out where they're going to build the next, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that will flip a neighborhood, especially here in Detroit. So we wanted to give that same opportunity to organizers. So specifically folks that are organizing land trusts, that are trying to buy their homes in their neighborhood and that are in foreclosure to ensure that their neighbors can stay there, to buy up homes that are from a community perspective so that you're not just getting strangers that are coming in saying, this is a cheap house, but you're keeping the residents of Detroit who stayed here throughout this whole long, painful revitalization process that they actually get to stay. And so we're learning that the thing that is a barrier to all of this to being able to interact in a digital age is digital literacy. The information of what we know about technology is really limited to based on what it's capable of. We know that our phones can do X, Y, and Z, but then how it's used and how it's developed, like, I think needs to be more in the hands of the users. Mm. So our work is really trying to figure out how to shift that to where instead of having Apple and Microsoft sort of tell us what's next, that neighborhoods are able to say what they need and then develop what's next.
So you're leading classes then with folks in Detroit to help them better understand their digital footprint?
Yes, there's two approaches that we have. One is called a discotech, which is short for Discovering Technology.
Okay.
And yes, there is disco music that's played during the discotheques. And basically those actually were formed from the Digital Justice Coalition in efforts to understand, like, what digital literacy do we need, that do people want? Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that you work with a community anchor org. So for instance, we're working with a library coming up. And we're saying, like, what do you think people will want? And so then we'll try to solicit these stations to create, like, almost like a science fair of people teaching and learning tech with each other. Mm. And so sometimes that looks like elders teaching other elders how they use Facebook, or getting someone else an email address, or sharing something like what a mesh network is, or having people do this what's in your wallet workshop that I talked about earlier. And the idea is that, like, you're not necessarily bringing experts to people, but you're bringing the expert out in people. Because the digital technology, whether you have access to the internet or not, is infused in our lives. Mm-hmm. Whether it holds your social security benefits, or whether it's like your day to day, you live by your phone, mm-hmm. or your Google Calendar or whatever, like, it is infused in our lives in a way that is as essential as water is. Mm. And so it's, people are already experts at it, but the way in which technology is being taught, we honor only those with computer science degrees to be able to tell us what's possible. And so our work at DCTP, the Detroit Community Technology Project, is trying to shift that narrative.
So it's about connecting people with others who already are using the technology in powerful ways that are potentially civically important.
Right, that relate to them. Because what, you know, Joe Schmo from downtown that works at, you know, the big tech firm has no idea what Sally blah, blah, blah in the North End needs. And so how would they know what to teach them? Mm-hmm. It's an assumption. And not all techies know how to interact with communities to ask or to even begin by listening. And that often is most of the work, is to teach people how to begin by listening.
So one part of what you do is this discotech educational event. You said there was a second wing of it.
So we also recently created this book called The Teaching Community Technology Handbook. And that has been the foundation to train trainers, basically, on some of our other curriculum. Mm-hmm. And our main curricula is the Digital Stewards program, which essentially trains residents in a neighborhood how to build, organize, and maintain a wireless network. And we got really, as we've been doing this work for the past 5 years and understanding mesh technologies, wireless technologies, and been working with this group, Open Technology Institute in DC. Yep, New America Foundation in New York. We work.
Disclosure, I'm a former employee of New America.
Oh, wow. Yeah, there's a lot of them. It's like you'll find a Detroiter wherever you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they really taught us a lot about what Mesh does. They were building this software called Commotion, and we were sort of a test bunny. And we combined our ability to do popular education and really create accessible technology to create this deeper curriculum called Digital Stewards that trains people in wireless engineering, and it's at a very high level.
This isn't just about setting up a router in your house that your neighbors can use.
No, this is about building a full-on infrastructure in your neighborhood.
Wow. How does that work?
So first we have to teach people how to organize.
Yeah.
And so we actually focus more on like training residents that are already organizers, because it is so much easier to teach someone technology than it is to teach someone organizing. And so we focus on those active residents in the neighborhood, and then we teach them about James and Grace Lee Boggs and their philosophies around organizing, which are really based in relationships.
Tell us who those people are.
Well, James Boggs and Grace Lee Boggs are incredible activists and mentors of mine and my colleagues here in Detroit. Grace Lee Boggs just recently passed at 100 years old a year ago. And her philosophy was that what I've learned from her is that if I transform myself, I transform the world around me, which I believe also is something Gandhi used to talk about too. Mm-hmm. And so that is that, and the way in which you do that is through building relationships, making connections, and then you can cultivate things that are meaningful and purposeful and that are sustainable.
So if I can be corny about it, you're... You're trying to help people build networks to build networks.
Yes.
To build networks.
Yes. Because I believe, and our model is that, yeah, it's like super like meta. I believe that economic revitalization actually starts from within a very small piece of people, mm-hmm. Or a microscopic moment of people relating to each other. Mm-hmm. And that's really intertwined into our curriculum, is that we talk a lot about relationship building. They learn collaborative facilitation. How do you generate ideas? How do you facilitate conversations a way that are inclusive, not just top down? So things like, you know, having people collage together to like come up with a new idea or whatever. So really kind of deconditioning the way in which we've been taught in some ways. We also teach people a little bit about preparedness plans, like how do you then activate your community to create a preparedness plan so that when you build this network, you can it has a purpose, that you can sort of prepare for a flood or a water shutoff for that matter. Mm. And they sort of think about the purpose of the network before they learn the tech, and they learn they go deep into organizing and the history of organizing in Detroit before they go into the tech. And then they learn about wireless engineering, and they go deep into different routers, line of sight, mapping assets, rooftop assessments, all that, organizing building owners to get on their rooftop to be able to put a router up. Mm-hmm. The class itself looks like people messing with routers and doing a little bit of programming to get in, learning IP addresses, what the internet is. I mean, it's really complex. And yeah. Like, sometimes I'm just like, I don't know, like how we do it, but I do. It's through popular education. It's through taking the moment to figure out how to teach in a way that's relevant to people. And that's why we built the handbook, because we realized that it's the foundation of all of this is how we teach and learn with each other.
In communities where people don't have access, or at least easy access to internet, what are the sort of material or personal or communal effects of that? How does that bear really specifically, do you think, on the lives of Detroit residents?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because I think the way in which to answer that is for you to think about all the ways in which the internet is interwoven in your life. Mm. And then imagine not having that. Mm-hmm. I can't speak to what people's experiences are because I think they're so different. But if you just take a second to imagine what life would be like without the internet, I think you'll have your answer.
It's almost impossible.
I know, right? I feel like I'm like, sometimes when I'm with my elders, and I feel so lucky because the organizing community here is so packed with amazing elders, we always are like, wait, how did you guys organize things without the internet? And so there's this interesting symbiosis happening in Detroit that I love so much, where the elders really keep us informed about what the old processes were so we don't lose sight of connecting with each other, while we're also teaching our elders how to use social media to advance their efforts.
How to connect in new ways.
Uh-huh. Yep.
When you actually are able to help a community set up internet for the first time, give people access, how does it change? Are there particular things you've seen people get excited about, or particular things that have shifted in the patterns of their lives and their communities?
Right. I think it's so hard to track, though, right? Because we use the internet in so many different ways, and it has such a function. But what I see people get excited about, specifically in working in the discotheques, I see elders get really excited about the capabilities of their phone and mm-hmm. their ability to connect with their grandchildren, to see pictures of their grandchildren, to take photos and to send them online, to put an article of their business out without having to wait for someone to write it, and to create a website that allows them to sell products, to having this intranet that they can use as a bulletin board so they, like a organization or a block club, can disseminate information a lot easier. The thing that I'm most excited about with our newest project is that the Grace in Action group that we're working with in Southwest Detroit, which is one of the most polluted areas in the United States because of the oil refineries and everything that's sort of around it, they are excited about finally being able to do air quality monitoring because they haven't been able to move any sort of legislation around air pollution in that area because they keep getting told that there's no way for them to collect that data. And so they're excited about being able to collect the data and making a case for it, mm-hmm. While also being able to communicate and share with each other when something's wrong. Like, let's say they need to not be out smelling the air, they can use their network to warn people. It's incredible the ideas that people have. There's no one particular thing that will change once you get the internet. It really depends on what your interests are. When we had this class and we asked people, like, what was your first experience online? There was an elder who was 78 at the table who used to work on the Morse code. So he remembers the switch from Bell to the internet and creating the first sort of network in the 60s. And then we had a millennial, a young person in the room who had got on the internet in 2002. So someone who experienced the internet in the 60s and someone who experienced it in 2002. And you know what? Their reflection was exactly the same. They were completely overwhelmed with the possibilities. And I think that when someone gets online for the first time, I think that's true to a lot of people, even people who are very seasoned. There's just so much out there. Like, what do you concentrate on? And so I think that's why we try to bring people online together as a community, because it's a scary place. It's like space. Like, what do you expect? You know, can we breathe in here? You know? And so it's sort of like, as a community, you can start to build the equivalent to like parks and bike lanes and sidewalks that people can navigate, because essentially the internet is this digital architecture that like overlays all of our lives. And like, as we develop and build land, like we develop and build the internet with our, what we consume and produce on it. And so I think that's a really long way of saying, I think it completely changes someone's life when they're able to access information in a way that makes sense to them.
Do you work with people to help them negotiate the darker or more troubling sides of the internet, the troll factories of Twitter, or even the more mundane problems of addiction to social media and such?
Yeah, and I think that actually happens in more of a physical form, where we are, that's where the community organizing and the participatory facilitation teaching comes into place, is that like if we can foster relationships and understand how to navigate hard times with each other in the physical world, we can do that in the digital world as well. But one way that we help navigate the sort of darker side of the internet is really training people in producing rather than consuming. So we're not teaching people how to, this is the website you go to for this, or this is this resource. We're teaching them how to make media, how to tell their stories, and then how to then put that online. Because that's how you sort of shift that darker side, right? Is by flooding it with things that actually are relevant to you and that you care about.
Yeah. I love it.
You're listening to Diana Nucera, director of the Detroit Community Technology Project. After this break, she talks about her role in the organization.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So what is your role in all of this?
Right. So as the director of the Detroit Community Technology Project, the day-to-day is a lot of conversations, and I think I hold the overall vision. I like, as far as developing the program and the intricacies of how one thing leads to another. And my job is to make sure everyone is aware of that, help them troubleshoot problems along the way, because no plan ever goes as planned. There's drama that occurs, you know, like we're human. Like some people want to fire other people. And I'm like, don't do that. We just spent like a year training them. some people like get stressed out because there's stuff like contracts and negotiations that we have to do. And so my job is to make sure that I really build the capacity of my team to be able to do this work, and that they can then build the capacity in these organizations that we work in.
How many people are you managing or overseeing?
Currently, I have 4 staff members that work in the office, and I'm working with 6 folks throughout our sites. But that will double in a couple months, and we'll have another 6. So there'll be, what is that, 12 plus 4, 16 people.
Plus you, 17.
Plus me. And yeah.
And are they full-time people, or are they volunteers?
No, I truly believe in paying people for this work. Like, this is no, I mean, it's a labor of love, and it's very stressful, you know? Like, organizing is no small feat. And so I have I have 2 part-time employees, one that works specifically on our data justice work that is doing a lot of the research in people's relationship with data. And then I have a graphics designer, I have a full-time coordinator and a full-time IT coordinator, but I also have a contracted IT network engineer. And then, so that's my team.
Where is the funding for all of this coming from? You're a 501c3, you're a nonprofit. You've probably, I assume, must spend a fair amount of your time. You didn't say you have a fundraising person, did
you?
Oh,
yeah, yeah. So that's the other part of it. There's like working on the people to make sure that, you know, like life is good and that we're relating well. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I call it the deep tissue massaging, you know, like you're just always like kind of rather than the firefighter, because I think the massaging prevents the fires, you know. I'll put out a fire if I need to. But the other side of it is really thinking about this, the fundraising, and always hustling, like contracts, always hustling ways in which we can take the materials that we've already built and have earned income with them, or support other people in doing the same projects, so that this idea of community technology is like more spread out. I mean, there's a whole lot of thinking about the future, always. I feel like my brain is like a year ahead. And so like I've become really good at time hacking, is what I call it.
In the sense of making the best use of your time, or
in the sense of stretching time out, in the sense of like what it means is like, so I know in July or September fundraising has to begin, but I know that already in May. So how can I lay the seeds so that it's like, you know, you get more done. And the more you know about the work that you do, the more you can get ahead of the game. You start to think about triangulation with people that you want to like support or invest in your project. So it's sort of like, I don't know, sometimes I feel like a psychic or something. Like are like these like weird like calendar powers. Just the fact that we were able to schedule this is like a miracle.
We're so glad you did.
So
does that come at all? Is it just a function of running a nonprofit generally, do you think? Or does it come that sort of futurological thinking come of working on technology, working on helping people catch up with the present moment, catch up to the present moment, and also anticipate where they're going, how they're getting there?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think because we're working with technology, we have to think about 5 years down the line, because what we're doing now may not make sense then. Right. And so we need to understand the root of the problems, right? So we're heading in the right direction. Then the other part comes with, like we live in Detroit. We are a nonprofit. We're hustling like everybody else is. I mean, there's a saying, Detroit hustles harder. It's so true. And it's like so many people wear a million different hats, you know, in order to get this work done. And it's a labor of love. And I think that's why people love Detroit so much. And when they come here, they want to be a part of it, because people do what they love. A lot of them do. I mean, there's a lot of folks that are not able to do that. But I feel like the working as a nonprofit in Detroit, you are faced with navigating a low resourced area. People are, there's a culture within nonprofits in general to fight for funding rather than to join forces for funding. And I feel like that's also work that Allied Media Projects is doing. And you also just constantly have these other things besides the tech that's changing. The landscape of Detroit is changing so rapidly. Then you have to be aware of what issues that are important, because they can change from week to week, from like gentrification looks like this, or it looks like this. And like, it feels like we have to just be grounded in like what we're doing and understand that purpose, so that we can sort of drown out the noise, or at least not at ambulance chase, because it's very easy to do so. Like when, I mean, the city is flipping around. It's like wild. Every day is so different. It's not the same as when I arrived in 2008. Like my own rent has gone up a ton, you know, like there's funders like really own the landscape at some points. And so I think the hats and the time hacking and the calendar stuff is like also a sense of understanding your purpose and a sense of what is needed and sticking to it and not being changed, but changing the narrative of what other people think need to be changed. Because you'll have moments of funders or corporate, whatever, like trying to say, this is the new hot thing, or trying to change the name from, this is not community technology, this is civic technology. And so a lot of the work is really holding ground and saying, no, it's actually this. And I think, honestly, I think that's why some of the respect that we've gotten is to not like sort of flow, but to balance out like changing and evolving with the times, but while also holding who we are and being very true to the needs of Detroit and the people we work with.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So how did you get into this work in the first place?
The Allied Media Conference. The Allied Media Conference changed my life, brought me into Allied Media Projects. It happens every year in Detroit in the summer. And I went to the first one when I was 17 years old as a little Midwest zine hopper and little punk. And 2005, I found myself going back as a youth media educator.
Were you focused on technology at the time?
Yeah, I've been focused technology a lot of my life. I think just like I don't know if I'm a millennial or not. I think I'm in that like weird like Generation Y zone or something. But once the internet was introduced in my life, I was like, wow, let's do this. You know, I was like, yes, thank goodness I was born in this era. You know, I think I saw the potential of it really early. And as a, I remember it my junior year in high school, having to use it, the internet, and that really changing my perspective of life.
Mm-hmm. Are you from Detroit originally?
No, I grew up in a small town in Indiana, Frankfort, Indiana, born in Chicago, did my schooling in San Francisco and Chicago, and then was recruited to come help move the AMC, the Allied Media Conference, from Bowling Green, Ohio to Detroit, and to bring my education, my media and technology education skills to Detroit to also allow for there to be more local programming, because the conference is a national conference. Mm-hmm. And so ever since 2005, that day that I went to the AMC again,
yeah.
I just started really getting into this work, and one thing has led to another, and now the Detroit Community Technology Project's my baby.
So when you were a zine scene kid, what was it that pulled you to the Allied Media Conference? What was it at the time that attracted you to it?
Well, I was fortunate enough to have a crew of friends that we were like a punk pact, basically. Uh-huh. I hung out with a lot of the older kids. Some of them were already out of school, and they were involved in this DIY punk scene. And so Punk Planet, which is a magazine that Ann Elizabeth Moore, who now lives in Detroit, which I'm so excited about, created in Chicago specifically for folks like myself that were like different. And they had, I think that's where I got a lot of information. I think Bitch Media also started around that time. And so they also like had, it was like that scene, which I think really came out of the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, which is now known as the Battle of Seattle.
Mm-hmm. And what was that, 99?
1999, yeah. The Battle of Seattle was basically this movement around anti-globalization. So thinking about the United States and like Western powers really impacting global economy. And this was, you know, like prior to the internet really having like a huge push on that. So it was all these World Trade Organizations sort of meeting in Seattle, and in the anti-globalization movement kind of culminating at that moment. Allied Media Projects came out of that. The Beehive Design Collective came out of that. A lot of what we know now is like these media-based organizing sort of projects came out of that.
So what at that point was the Allied Media Conference? Is it something that has changed over the years?
Oh, yes, absolutely. At the time, it was the Midwest Zine Fest, which mm-hmm. was an independent publishing conference.
Right, because zines are these like usually handmade, super personal like mini publications.
Right, right.
In many ways, progenitors of early blogs and things like this. Yep. Totally offline for the most part.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I never thought of it that way. But yeah, it was sort of like people taking publications into their own hands and saying, hey, we're going to do this. Just like at the time, the DIY punk scene was that you were going to publish your own music, mm-hmm. which was like pre... Napster or whatever, you know, like I feel like, or not, maybe not pre-Napster, but I feel like Napster has something to do with it.
So you've always been sort of embedded in this scene that's about taking agency, not just over media consumption, but media production and engagement,
right.
Well before the rise of the modern commercial internet in some ways.
Yeah.
Or at least the modern commercial internet as we know it now.
Yeah. And I think that being a part of that DIY punk scene really politicized me in thinking about class war. Mm. And classism. And I think it really struck me because I grew up in Indiana and I was one of four families of color. I didn't understand why people treated me different. I wasn't aware of like what it meant to be a woman of color till I had left Indiana. But I think that that inherently politicized me, that when I found this scene, I was like, oh yes, I understand. You know, like I understand why we need to fight for difference and why homogeny is so destructive. And so, yeah, essentially that's led me to where I am now, but really thinking about the internet and technology and how that can really foster difference. Mm-hmm. I just like enhance people in so many ways.
How has your role within this work changed over the years?
Right.
Within these scenes, I guess.
Yeah, it's been so interesting. Gosh, I feel like a whole different person. You know, because I've been able to do this work, but also just the time gone by, I'm like no spring chicken anymore. But I went from organizing this how-to track, which is what it said, people teaching how to do things. That turned into like a DIY tech track, which then turned into this thing called a media lab, which was a potluck of technology for people to teach and learn together.
Were you learning a lot about technology in this period? I mean, did you...
This is all how I learned about technology.
Right, so you didn't like do like formal schooling or something in this stuff.
I did my undergrad in, in art and technology. Mm-hmm. But it was weird. It's like... I learned differently than the way I was taught. So a lot of my interactions with technology has been taking it apart or experimenting what I can do to combine things. So like my thesis was in grad school was like making a program for my cello to like control video. Mm-hmm. So I could play a thunderstorm. So it's like stuff like that. But I was always intimidated by it because, one, men were always teaching me and they undermined me a lot. So I never got to just like fully go into it or ask questions in a way that felt comfortable. I think that informed the way in which I approach technology now. And the one thing sort of was led to another. So this media lab turned into the idea of a discotheque. The discotheque showed us what digital literacy can look like in the city. And then this like deep love for education and this also this personal experience of being not being taught in this way that I needed to figure out this pedagogy of community technology and to then be able to teach others that. So it's sort of a long, twisty line, but all with this sort of underlying tone of accessibility and fostering difference and... just really making sure the things we do are rooted in need, which seems so simple, but because of all the bells and whistles of tech, like I think it's hard for people to do that.
Yeah. So how long have you been in Detroit itself now?
Nearly 10 years.
Has the city's relationship to technology changed during that time, you think?
Oh, yeah. Like, it's nuts. We recently got a chief information technology officer. I don't think we had one before. Mm-hmm. The open data portal, or if we did, it's like a long time. So just the fact that the city even opened the data is nuts because like our infamous mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, actually had an ordinance that forbade that. Hmm. And that's probably why he got to do a lot of the corruption that he did get to do. And then we also have smart city conferences coming to Detroit, thinking about what's possible, you know, like with this clean slate, you know, I think that's how people think about it.
Do you think that's an accurate characterization of the city? That it's a technological
clean slate?
Absolutely
not. No, like, but it's like, it's, I mean, it's the home of the automobile. Yeah. It is where I think where a lot of technology was incubated. Like yeah. the, I mean, if you want to track our cyborgism, it goes back to the car. Mm. and so like there's been a deep history of like innovation and technology in the city that I think people forget about because of our economic decline that lasted so long.
You also have here offices of major tech companies. Microsoft has a big office here, I think. Oracle, I think IBM does even. Does the presence of these kind of tech behemoths make a difference at all in a city that it seems like it's also really marked by huge disparities of access and education and understanding around technology?
Does their presence make a difference in that? No, because they're not talking to any of those people. Mm-hmm. And that's why we do what we do. And that's why we're important, I think, in this landscape. And that they also come to us a lot for advice. Yeah. Like, I think even though we've been doing this work for so long, like recently now people realize like, we don't know how to get into that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so it makes it like, it's like actually an opportunity for us to allow people to be better players or teach them how to do that, or at least kind of swing people into a different direction, you know, to say, hey, that's not going to make any sense. Like, okay, you're going to put internet in a light pole. Wonderful. How are people going to use it? You know, like they're not going to stand there. Don't you know that like it's, no one wants to be walking around at night, even if it is lit up. Like, you know, if, so the thing is that the problem is a lot of the people that are, I would say that there's not a whole lot of people that are in those companies that actually live in the city and have experienced the city for its whole self.
Because they live out in the suburbs or just
suburbs, or they're living in an area that's like, you know, in East English Village or like Indian Village or places that are really nice. And I think that without that knowledge, there's a big disconnect to what is actually necessary. So sure, we could build, like, people want streetlights. They've been putting up their own, neighborhoods have been putting up their own streetlights. Like, but now we have lights that are LED operated with like, or that are, you know, online, that shut off on their own and like conserve energy and maybe shoot out internet. Like, it's sort of like we laid the foundation for that to happen, you know? And I think some people think about these corporations are the ones that are coming in and revitalizing Detroit. Well, that's not true at all. It's been the people who have been here for the longest time who have been doing the work and grinding. It has actually opened up the opportunity for them to have this moment. Mm. And it is, it's like, it is so important that they work with the organizers within the city if they want to be successful, because I don't think people are going to know how to actually get their services into some of these neighborhoods because they have no idea who these people are and what they experience.
Does it feel weird at all to have maybe helped facilitate or engender some of that gentrification? If I understand what you're saying, right, that that... and gentrification may not even be the right word here, but that the work that you've been doing for more than a decade now has maybe made possible some of these flashy smart city innovations and such that may or may not be useful.
Yeah. Like, is that true? I think that's a question. Okay.
Maybe it's the wrong question that I've asked them.
I think that the work that we have done and the work that a lot of the organizing, the grassroots organizations in Detroit have kept Detroit alive. Mm. I don't know if they led the way to gentrification, but I know that they kept the city alive in order for it to actually even occur. Okay. And there's not a whole lot of credit for that. People forget about the very dark days. Yeah. And that a lot of the like narrative really goes to like Mike Duggan or Dan Gilbert, the mayor and, you know, major billionaire developer, that they're the ones that revitalized Detroit, where they put in fancy housing that no Detroiters can actually live in. They're bringing people into Detroit. But what has kept Detroit alive are those neighborhoods that are very poor, are those like grassroots groups. And whether or not we can shift or change, it's like it all is going to live in the same space. Mm-hmm. And the question now is more like, how will it interact? How will we interact with each other? What are the community benefits that will happen with this new development? What is the role of these people who did keep this soil alive? What is their role going to be in this new development? And so my job is to ensure that they have a seat at the table and they have the knowledge that they need in order to participate in developing their neighborhoods.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share your work with us today.
Thanks for wanting to listen.
It's such a delight.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Rogan. Thanks also to Maya Wagner, who recommended that we talk to Nucera. We'd love to hear your thoughts about Working. Our email address is working@slate.com, and you can listen to past episodes at slate.com/working. But if you're all caught up, check out Slate's podcast, I Have to Ask, where Isaac Chotiner talks with a wide array of exciting guests about some of the most pressing cultural and political issues of the present day. Working is produced and edited by Mickey Capper.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.